your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got one of the finest guests that we've ever interviewed. Over about 11-year period here, and he's the author of The Innocence of Oswald. But that book is so in depth. But also he has some updates for us. So welcome to our program, Gary Fannin.
Thank you, George. Thank you for having me on again.
Boy, I tell you what, you really that book. I've read it again. You know, I read it the first time, and then I went back and reviewed it before this interview. And you have, what, 35 color photographs in there? And it just goes on and on. I mean, it's just a really one book that's an in-depth book for that assassination of JFK.
Well, I appreciate the comments. And what I like to tell everybody about my book is the way that it's different than most assassination books is I primarily use government documents from the FBI, from the CIA, the Secret Service, Dallas Police Department, Dallas Affidavits, and Dallas Autopsy Reports to basically prove that Oswald could not have been the assassin of JFK, and had he gone to court, anybody could have gotten him off on that charge.
Right, and you also, there's been more information out about LBJ, is that right?
Correct, and obviously Woody Harrelson is playing him in a film that's due to come out on November 3rd, but I'm sure they won't go into all the dark secrets of LBJ. And for people that are not familiar with LBJ as far as being with Kennedy, he basically blackmailed himself onto the ticket, and Robert Kennedy immediately tried to get him off of the ticket. And if you go to, I believe it's oldlifemagazines.com, you can actually pull up the Life magazines from November 8th of 1963 and November 22nd of 1963. Back then they did Life magazine every 2 weeks. And the magazines, those particular two issues, it's all about LBJ's path, catching up to him, with Billy Saul Estes and the illegal cotton allotments in Texas, and the Bobby Baker scandals with vending machines and so forth in D.C. And basically, I believe that this information was being leaked to Life magazine by the Kennedy family, possibly Robert Kennedy through Arthur Kroc of the New York Times. And the next issue, December 6th, had JFK not been assassinated, would have been the issue that would have basically nailed Lyndon Johnson and forced him to resign. And at that point, Robert Kennedy would have had no choice but to basically go after him in federal court and put him away for life. And that is one of the reasons why I think Lyndon Johnson was, you know, partially behind the assassination of JFK. He definitely had motive.
Yeah, he did. You know, being in Austin and knowing my family knew the Johnson family, my uncle was closer to him than my father. My father never spoke well of LBJ. You know, when we were growing up, we always heard that LBJ was tied to Brown and Root and all that other stuff. See what I mean?
Right.
So, and then I flew back. I flew back on one of LBJ's planes that Christmas after the assassination. I was in the Army, and I got a hop back from Austin after Christmas holidays on his cooks and bottle washers plane. It was a Convair, and it was, you know, it had all the White House staff that was working in the kitchen. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so that was
kind
of, but we didn't know all of this then, of course, you know, and but we were just getting a hop back. But anyway, this movie that's coming out, tell us something about that or that DVD and so forth.
Well, are you talking about the LBJ movie or?
Yes, uh huh.
Well, it's Woody Harrelson, ironically, is playing LBJ, and the. It's going to be, you know, mostly about civil rights and so forth. But the interesting part to me was Robert Rodin's assistant, Marshall Evans, was used as an advisor to the film. And it's also ironic to me that, you know, Woody Harrelson's father was rumored to be one of the three tramps, Charles Harrelson. So for Woody to, you know, make the stretch and play LBJ is kind of ironic to me.
Yeah, tell us, our listening audience, a little bit about Grogan. How does he enter into this story?
Well, Robert Grogan, like I said, his assistant was an advisor on this movie, LBJ, and he actually asked Woody Harrelson if he thought that Charles Harrelson was one of the three tramps, and Woody believes that he was. And, you know, Robert Grogan is a man that most people in the research community know him, obviously, but he's the guy that originally aired the Zapruder film on national TV with the late Dick Gregory on, I believe it was March 6th of 1975, on Geraldo Rivera's Late Night America talk show. And obviously, since Geraldo Rivera is now at Fox News, you know, he has completely changed his course and, you know, now obviously believes that Oswald was the lone shooter, even though back in 1975 on his show, he said that the Zapruder film was one of the most horrific things he'd ever seen, and that it proved that there had to be a shot from the front. And, you know, there's even in the new files that have just been released, I haven't had, I mean, obviously you're talking thousands of pages.
Right.
And I haven't had a time to go through all of them. But the one document that I find very interesting already in the documents that I've researched is from January 31st of 1964, and it's about the FBI talking about a report that the president's own Surgeon General's report, his own doctor's report on the assassination, stated that the first bullet entered the president's throat below the Adam's apple, clearly showing that two persons were involved, and that with the first shot being fired from the bridge across the parkway, there indeed he paused in front of the car. And to further substantiate this report, they said that there was a bullet hole in the windshield of the president's car. And there's six witnesses that they list to seeing the bullet hole through the windshield of the car, and all of them say from front to rear, which again would be an entry wound. And I even have in my book, I even have an FBI report dated 11/23/63, the day after the assassination, from J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, and it even states that there's a windshield crack in the a bullet hole through the windshield, because it says that they did a scraping of the surface of the inside part of the windshield, which would indicate a shot from the front to the rear because they're testing for fragmentation on the inside. So, you know, again, all of this is quickly suppressed, you know, with the Warren Report, and nobody, you know, even questions anything that the Warren Report ever did from 64, and now, obviously, everything is starting to fall apart. And again, it clearly shows, you know, if there's a bullet hole in the windshield of the president's car. I even talked to Tom Robinson of Gawler's Funeral Home, who's the gentleman that embalmed JFK, and he said that he had to put extra, what he called, I believe he called it pancake powder or something like that, but basically it's makeup on JFK's face and neck area, because he said that there were glass shards in his neck and cheek area, basically from that bullet that came through the windshield, because he said the embalming fluid was leaking out through these, you know, glass fragments.
Oh, my God.
So again, I mean, I joke around with people all the time. When I say I've talked to everybody, I mean, I literally talked to everybody. I talked to the captain of Air Force One that day, James Wendell, again, has passed away now. I talked to doctors that worked on JFK and Oswald in Parkland, people at the autopsy. Hubert Clark, one of the Honor Guard members, lives 15 minutes from me. We have lunch every week and talk about this. And like I said, these reports are slowly starting to come out, and these files are slowly starting to come out. And even though Trump held back over 200 files, which is obviously the most damning information to the CIA and the FBI, you know, there's still a lot of information out there. There's one of the reports that was recently released as well, says that the officer that was shooting from the front, they claim that J.D. Tippit shot JFK from the grassy knoll. I mean, this is, again, another document that's just been released. And even in my book, I had Tippit basically as being the badge man image. I didn't list it in my book out of two things. One is out of respect for Tippit's widow, Marie, and two of the three children that are still living. And the second reason is, obviously, is I didn't want to be sued by him if I said, well, Tippit was a dirty cop and, you know, shot him from that area. But it would make sense why, you know, Tippit would become expendable at that point.
Right. You have Roscoe White in there, though, as a prominent shooter, right?
I definitely have Roscoe White there, but he's not the bad man image. Roscoe was about 8 to 10 feet down from the corner of the picket fence.
Okay.
And the reason why I say that is, again, researcher Gary Shaw had access to all of Roscoe White's documents, and they're at the Pogue Library there in Waco on the campus of Baylor. And I looked at Roscoe's little green book that he called his Witness Elimination Program book, and it clearly states in the Mary Mormon photograph, he puts an X on the picture as to where he is standing when he shot JFK, and he admits in his book that he killed JFK from the stockade fence area, and that he shot and killed a police officer at 10th and Patton. Now, he doesn't say Officer Tippit, but obviously that's where Officer Tippit was killed. And Roscoe even admitted to his wife, Geneva, the morning of the assassination that he was ordered to kill JFK that day, and Geneva was basically, you can't do this, Rock. And he's like, well, obviously they know more about the situation than we do, and if I don't follow orders, they'll kill you, they'll kill, you know, our boys, you know, they'll kill me. So he even admitted to his wife the morning of the assassination. But again, in this other document where it talks about Tippit shooting at JFK from behind the fence, again, I believe he was possibly the badge man image that the late Gary Mack and Jack White discovered in the Mary Mormon photograph.
Boy, your book is so fascinating. You know, Gary, and the photographs, too, of the Dealey Plaza give the reader a really well, you know, diagrammed idea of what went on there. And I encourage everyone to come to the site, theinnocenceofoswald.com, or they can even go to Amazon. Is that right?
Yeah, to purchase the book, they can go to either. But I have on my website.
Okay.
I have a lot of the documents and a lot of the photographs that are used in the book. And the photographs that you're talking about, I think, at the very end, which lays out the details of the assassination, where the shooters were, and so forth. You know, that is one photograph that I took that basically I just kept, you know, duplicating the photograph and putting in shooters. And the way that I came to those conclusions as far as angles of the shots and so forth, you know, I went to the University of Texas a few years, the year that I was writing my book, and I looked at the clothing that John Connolly wore and looked at the angles of the entrance wound and everything, and when I, you know, projected it with the angle that Connolly was sitting in the car, it pointed back towards the county records building, very high up, either at the top window or the roof. And so that's how I got a shooter from that angle, is because the way that the angle of the bullet trajectory going through the clothing, it was, I believe, either 21 or 22 degrees from left to right, and that would only again, have them at the county records building. And most people think, well, obviously somebody would see somebody with a gun at that building. Well, you wouldn't think anything of it because, for one, the county records building in 63 was, I believe, the sheriff's office and where the district attorney's office was. And, you know, if you saw someone dressed as a police officer on the roof of a building with a gun, you would just think, well, he's there for security. You wouldn't think he'd actually be shooting.
You think he's there protecting the you know, the president.
Exactly.
Yeah, motorcade.
Exactly. But like I said, I'm, you know, all of those angles and everything in my book and the trajectories and so forth, I mean, I analyzed all of them, you know, completely before I came with those conclusions. And except for the fact that I have Johnson crony Mack Wallace shooting from the so-called sniper perch, and Roscoe White shooting from the Crafty Knoll area. The other shooters that I mentioned in my book, could they have been in different locations and so forth? Yes. I put them in the locations that I did based upon their skill level and the difficulty of the shot and so forth. But again, you know, Frank Sturgis could have been in a different location. This guy could have been in a different location. You know, but I based it on the skill levels and the difficulty of the shots. But I know for a fact, because of the Mack Wallace fingerprint that was found in 1998 on the cardboard box, I know for a fact he was in that window, and I know for a fact because I saw Roscoe White's witness elimination program book that he was standing where he was standing.
Right.
So,
what about this fellow that got out of prison recently? Is it Files is his name? How does he figure into this?
James Files.
Yeah.
Well, James is an interesting character, you know.
He seemed to have some of the names right from Chicago, say. Okay?
Right. And he claims that he was the assassin of JFK and that he was hired that morning to do the job. I personally don't put a lot of faith in Files. But, you know, again, he was singing like a canary when he was in prison. And once he got out in, I think, April of this year, nobody's heard from him.
Right.
So
you're saying
I don't put a lot of faith in him.
Yeah, you're saying that Roscoe White had an elimination book.
Correct.
Of about what 28 people or something in that book.
Well, he admitted to his pastor on his deathbed.
Okay.
That he had killed 28 people on both foreign and domestic soil to cover up the assassination.
Really?
Of JFK.
Oh, my God.
And in his witness elimination program book, whenever somebody would die, whether by his calls or somebody else's calls, if he had a picture of them in that book, he simply just marked a line through their face to signify that they were dead. And when I talked to his pastor, because, again, pastors are like doctors. They're like lawyers. They're not supposed to, you know, reveal, you know, private conversations.
There's a confidentiality there, yeah.
Yeah, so the way I quoted it to his pastor, Jack Shaw, was, you know, that he, you know, basically said that he had killed 28 people to help cover up the death of JFK, and his pastor said to me, that number sounds about right.
Really?
It wasn't a way. Yeah, he didn't say yes it happened that way or no or whatever. He just said that number sounds about right. So I took it for what it meant as, yeah, you get your information correct.
Right. What other facets of this that do you want to discuss this evening? You laid out four or five different things, and I didn't write them down. But what other items here of interest do you think our listening audience would welcome?
Well, one of the things that I would, you know, another item that I would like to just discuss real quick about Roscoe White, and to me, this was the most damning information of anything that I saw when I went to the Pogue Library with for Gary Shaw. That, you know, like I said, he gave me access to everything, and that would be the documents that Roscoe White had from the Office of Naval Intelligence. And in these documents, they are basically, and these are in my book, these documents, it basically shows the Office of Naval Intelligence ordering the assassination of JFK. The first one is dated in September of 63, and for whatever reason, Rock went by the code name Mandarin, and if you've read a lot of books about the assassination, they always talk about Mandarin, Lebanon, and Saul as code names. But this particular document from Navy Intelligence has a number on it, which is 166-106, and that just happens to be Roscoe White's Marine identification number. And it says September 63, it says, remarks Mandarin, Dallas destination chosen, your place hidden within the department, contacted within the letter, continue on as planned. Now, at first observation of the document, Dallas destination chosen, you think that they're choosing the assassination site, and it says your place hidden within the department. What this document actually says is somebody at Navy Intelligence has been able to get Roscoe White a job with the Dallas Police Department as a photography expert in 1963. Now, you know, who did Navy Intelligence talk to? I mean, was it Captain Prince? I mean, you know, Jesse Curry, who did they talk to? But obviously they got him a job there in the police department in the field of photography. And then the next document is from October 63, again from the Office of Naval Intelligence, again 166-106. And this one is the most damning document out there. It says, foreign affairs assignments have been canceled. The next assignment is to eliminate a national security threat to worldwide peace. Destination will be Houston, Austin, or Dallas. Contacts are being arranged now. Orders have changed at any time. Reply back if not understood. Okay, foreign affairs assignments have been canceled. The next assignment is to eliminate a national security threat to worldwide peace. This one document says, we're not going to kill Fidel Castro. We're going to kill JFK.
Oh my God.
And then the final document after the assassination in December of 63, again, has his Navy ID number, again from Navy Intelligence, says, stay within the department. Witnesses have eyes, ears, and a mouth. You had nothing to do with the mix-up. The men will be in to cover all misleading evidence soon. Again, stay within the department. Witnesses have eyes, ears, and a mouth. This is where Roscoe basically started eliminating people that would come in and tell a different story than what the police, you know, had or what the Warren Commission was eventually going to say. The men will be in to cover all misleading evidence soon. I mean, this is basically the Warren Report being assigned to cover up everything.
Right.
And one of the things I like to say too, George, is,
yeah,
you know, with all these files being withheld for so long and now being released, if Oswald is the lone killer, according to the government, why do we have all these secret files from the CIA, FBI, on all these different individuals and people regarding the Kennedy assassination? It should just be one file on Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right. Well, we know the deep state was behind it, and they came together, right, and it was the beginning of consolidation and coordination of many of the factions that make up the deep state. And so they're,
correct,
we know they're just covering up the deep state here. They're hiding the deep state.
Well, and another thing too that most people didn't want to believe, you know, back then, they trusted our media at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, nobody that listened to Walter Cronkite would ever think he would lie about something. I mean, he was the most trusted man in America. But again, the film that I worked on with John Barber and Brian Lloyd and Meyer Bronstein and, I mean, several other people, the American media and the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the Jim Garrison tapes part two, we show over and over in that 2-hour and 10-minute documentary how Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather and all these journalists just continue to lie about what happened during the Kennedy assassination. And now that these documents are starting to come out and show more proof, you know, Trump talks about fake news all the time. Well, you know, the news has been, you know, fake basically since the Kennedy assassination. Every single person that works for a major media outlet, whether it's ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox News, New York Times, I mean, they're paid CIA assets. If Geraldo Rivera, you know, said that there was a conspiracy and then he changed his mind, Bill O'Reilly in the late 70s was working with Inside Edition. It was a conspiracy. And then, you know, he goes to work for Fox News and writes the book Killing Kennedy. The only thing that changed with those guys' opinions is they went to work for a major news corporation being funded by the CIA and being paid by the CIA.
Right, right. Today, what's really ridiculous, but a friend of mine asked me recently about these people that are coming out, and they're just reconfirming that Lee Harvey Oswald did it by himself. And people come up to me and say, what's that about? And I'll tell them, I'll tell you what it's about. We got younger generations that are being propagandized about this. See what I mean?
Exactly.
And so the younger people haven't looked into it like you have, Gary. You've done a supreme job for this world and for this country and in this area,
well,
especially.
And I appreciate that. I've studied this for 37 years now, and I'm, you know, 53 years old, so it's been my life's work.
Yes,
but,
it has.
You know, talking about you know, the younger generation and the media trotting out people saying Oswald's a lone person.
Right.
I mean, Gerald Posner has been on almost every single, you know, news station in the past couple weeks with the release of the document coming out. And all of them say he's the reliable source on this because he wrote a book called Case Closed back in 93.
Right.
This is the same guy that, you know, was accused of plagiarism, had to hire Mark Lane as an attorney to get him off of that charge. This is a guy that, again, his book is supporting the Warren Commission, 100%. Oswald was the lone person. He has no facts in there about the assassination. He basically concludes that based upon Oswald's mental capabilities, he was capable of killing the president. This is the same guy that goes into an assisted living facility and gets Harper Lee to sign over the rights to kill a mockingbird to him. And again, this is the authority that they're using.
Yeah.
A proven liar. And, you know, this is the authority that they're using. What if they have Dr. Cyril Webcom on their program?
Right, right. About a little over 2 years ago at the Texas Book Festival, they brought in this one guy that was on the committee that they discovered the magic bullet theory, remember?
Oh, yeah.
And he got up before the crowd in the C-SPAN tent. I forget the man's name. But he was on the committee that discovered this. That senator who later would become senator, what's his name?
Right.
You know who
Arlen
I'm talking
Spector.
About? Yeah, Arlen Spector was.
Spector.
They were all sitting around one day. This is the story he tells before. You know, a big 200 or 300 people in that C-SPAN tent at the Texas Book Festival, and all of a sudden, Arlen Spector jumps up and he says, "I've got it! This is what happened." See, and everybody was so astounded that he came up with this. This answer to this thing. Well, when the first person that got up to ask a question, and you know, people took that, you know, just as BS because they're not believing that anymore. But the first question to him was, "Mr. So and so, could you elaborate more on the magic bullet theory to us?" And everybody sort of chuckled under their breath because then the other guy that had up there with that. Was that Dallas Morning News reporter, you know?
Oh, yeah, Hugh Ainsworth.
Yeah, and he got up there and said his normal propaganda about Lee Harvey being the sole shooter. You know what I mean? So, So the Texas Book Festival was bringing in a bunch of propaganda, you know?
Well, and to elaborate on that even further, I debated Arlen Spector way back in the 90s.
Oh, okay.
And he called it his single bullet conclusion. Okay.
Yeah.
And so I at one of the conferences in Dallas, he was the puppet head that came down to say that the government got it right. And I asked him, I said, "Can you?" And there was probably a crowd of, you know, 1,000 people there.
Right.
And I asked him, "Can you describe your single bullet conclusion to this audience?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Oh, Gary." He goes, "It's been so long ago," he goes, "I can't remember it exactly." And I said, "Well, with all due respect, Senator," I said, "I wasn't born yet, but I know your single bullet conclusion." I said, "And with all due respect, except for the marriage to your wife and the birth of your children, it's the most important thing you've ever done in your life. And you're going to sit there and tell these people you don't remember it?"
Oh, Gary, that was good. Man.
Wait. And here's the other thing, too, okay? You want to prove the conspiracy immediately, and I do mean immediately, okay?
Yeah.
The single bullet, the magic bullet that was supposedly found.
Yeah.
Now, I am not an expert on guns or bullets or anything, but obviously I've done my research on this. But I believe they claimed that that particular bullet weighed 161 grains, I believe is what how they determined bullet weight.
Yeah.
And after the bullet was found, it weighed like 158, so it missed, you know, like 3 grains of it were missing.
Yeah.
Okay, so
yeah.
A very, very minimal weight. You look at the x-rays of John Connolly's wrist, and there's more metal fragments in there than what's missing from the, quote, magic bullet.
Right,
so
right.
So quick easy way to resolve this, if you exhume John Connolly's body today, the body is probably decayed to the point that you can literally just pull those bullet fragments out of the casket because they never took them out on surgery.
Right, right.
And that would clearly show that he was hit with a different bullet than the magic bullet.
Well, that thing was pristine when they found it out there on the stretcher, right? At Parker.
Oh, exactly. No blood
so,
on,
yeah,
it,
yeah.
On it.
So we think Jack Ruby, what, he dropped it out there, you think, or what?
That's what a lot of people think. And
yeah.
You know, I could see that happening, and there's reliable people like Seth Tanner that, you know, admitted that he saw Ruby at Parkland Hospital. You know, again, you were talking a little bit ago about Hugh Ainsworth.
Again, Ainsworth, yeah.
Hugh Ainsworth is supposedly just a Dallas street reporter.
Right.
Yet he's at, you know, Parkland Hospital. He's at the assassination site. He's at the site where, you know, Tippett's murdered. He's in the basement of, you know, the Dallas police station when Oswald's murdered. How did this guy just randomly know to go to all these special sites if he wasn't tipped off?
Right, right.
He got mad because I think it was Merriman Smith won the Pulitzer that year for journalism, if I remember correctly. And it's because Merriman Smith had sent out the teletype basically initially saying that John F. Kennedy had been shot. And Hugh Ainsworth has said on many occasions that Merriman Smith saw nothing and reported less, and he gets the Pulitzer. And I'm the only major news person to be in 4 different major areas of the crime, and I didn't win.
Oh, yeah, I see. Yeah.
Again, how did you know to be in all these locations?
Right, exactly. Well, he was there, and he said his spiel, you know, about Lee Harvey Oswald being the one, you know. And then they've got these puppets that run. They're running out now because of the release of the archives. What else is there on your mind this evening, Gary, to talk about?
This is one area that I'd like to bring up as well because I have done more and more research on this even lately, and that would be the story of Ruth and Michael Payne. And for people that do not have my book yet, I'll give out a little nugget of information here. But I put in my book that Ruth Payne is the person that delivers the Mannlicher Cartano rifle to the Dallas Police Department. Okay? Now, how I came up with that, okay, the day of the assassination, you know, it happens, Oswald is arrested, and he's arrested at 1:40 p.m. in Oak Cliff. It's probably a 15-20 minute drive to downtown Dallas police station. May have taken even a little bit longer with all the, you know, hectic chaos that was happening that day. They fingerprint him, they take his picture, and then they start interviewing and asking questions, probably 2:15, 2:20, 2:30, somewhere in that range. Well, Ruth Payne, and she admits this on the video, The Men Who Killed Kennedy in 1988, she says at 2 o'clock that day, 6 Dallas police officers showed up at her house. And she said, come on in, I've been expecting you. Well, why would she be expecting police officers to come to her house? Because he's arrested at 1:40, he's taken to the police station, They're leaving to come to Marina's house before they even have him in custody at Dallas Police Station, yet she says that they've been expected. She's been expecting them. They didn't have, you know, round-the-clock news. There was nobody saying, you know, at 1:40 in the afternoon, there was nobody saying, you know, it's Lee Harvey Oswald that did this. Why is she expecting them there?
Right. Exactly. Good point, Gary.
And here's the other point. You know, you can go on YouTube today, all of the major media in 1963, Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, all the newspapers, all the magazines, everybody was saying that the gun was a 7.65 Mauser. There's an affidavit in my book signed by Seymour Weitzman of the Dallas Sheriff's Office saying that the gun found was a 7.65 Mauser. But Oswald owned a 6.5 Mannlicher Carcano, okay? Now, when they can't tie the 7.65 gun to Oswald, it suddenly morphs into the 6.5. But here's the other thing. When the Dallas police came out to look at Marina's house, she asked them, do you have a warrant? And they said, no, but we can get one real quick. Well, she, you know, said, no big deal. She let him come on in anyhow. And she didn't know that he had a gun. And, you know, Marina said he did and that he kept it in the garage. And, you know, Ruth is trying to act like she didn't know he had a gun. I'm sorry. I mean, I've been in that house. I've been in that garage. It is a tiny two-bedroom house.
Right.
The garage was an area that Michael Payne, when he was living with Ruth, used as a workshop area. And, again, it was a small garage that would barely hold a car. And they didn't even put a car in there because, again, he had his woodworking stuff and everything in there. How do you not see a gun in there?
Exactly.
And
yeah.
I believe that the morning of the assassination, because, again, she claimed she, you know, went to buy a bunch of groceries, you know, I believe that particular morning she delivered that gun to somebody at the Dallas Police Department or met them off-site somewhere, because, again, suddenly Saturday afternoon at 6 o'clock, you know, Uncle Walter comes on the air and says, the 7.65 Mauser, you know, that was in error. You know, that was a rumor. The gun is actually a 6.5. He called it Mannlicher Carcano or something like that. But, again, the gun just morphs into another gun. And, again, in my book, the FBI report states, you know, that they don't have any fingerprints on the rifle, on the inner parts of the rifle, on the clip of the rifle, on Oswald's revolver. They don't have fingerprints on the two guns this man supposedly used to kill two different people.
I think the paraffin test was negative, too, wasn't it?
Exactly. And the way they changed that around was they, you know, lied and said it was positive. Well, it was positive for cardboard nitrates. Well, yeah, I mean, Oswald worked at the books depository stacking books into cardboard boxes.
Right.
But they took that cardboard and changed it to basically say he had fired a weapon.
Right, right.
And even on the weapon, okay, this is another part that I have in my book that most people don't even follow. They claim when they go to arrest Oswald at the Texas Theater that he pulled his gun and was going to, you know, fight his way out,
right,
and that the gun misfired and they were able to subdue Oswald. Well, once they got the gun to Dallas headquarters, they realized that the firing pin didn't line up with the chamber, so therefore, if, you know, when they say it misfired, well, it didn't strike the bullet. Well, how did it work 40 minutes ago when it supposedly killed Officer Tippett?
Well, there's another point, too, though. The shells that were picked up on the sidewalk, they had to have been ejected by a semi-automatic, and they don't pop out of a revolver.
Exactly. And again, on his autopsy, on Tippett's autopsy, he has two different types of bullets in his body. He has two .38 revolver bullets and two .38 automatics.
You think Tippett was involved in the shooting and they eliminated him because of a problem with him, or what?
I think Tippett was the badge man image.
Okay.
And I think his job immediately afterwards was to run into the school book depository building and basically kill Oswald, as
okay.
known for Hero Cop at that point. Well, the problem was Oswald wasn't on the sixth floor. He was out front watching it on the first floor. He then went to the lunchroom. So he was able to escape before Tippett was able to get over there. And at that point, I think Tippett became expendable.
Oh, okay. 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 So, man, I mean, you have it down to a great, now Jim Mars helped, did some of his research help you in your book at all?
Oh, most definitely. And, you know, I talked to Jim,
the late Jim Mars, you know, we're talking about, yeah.
Right. And, you know, speaking of that, it's been a tough year to be a JFK researcher because, I mean, besides Jim Mars, I mean, we lost Dick Gregory. We lost Sherry Feaster, author of Enemy of the Truth. We lost Dennis David, who was a corpsman at the autopsy. So it's been a tough year as a JFK researcher.
Right. Now, coming up this next month in November, 17th, 18th, and 19th, is the JFK conference. And I think it is the site jfkdallasconference.com. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And you got to go. You got to put the Dallas in there. JFKDallasConference.com. This is being produced by Judith Ferry Baker. You're going to be there, right?
Yeah, I've got several functions there. I'm speaking about three different times. I'm presenting Robert Groden with a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Okay.
I'm at these conferences every year, and you know, not just Judith's conference, but I mean. You know, JFK Lancer has their conference. Chris Gallup does a luncheon. It's for people that have never been. All of them are excellent. The reason why I'm at Judith's conference and have been for the last 3 years is just the quality and the, you know, number of speakers that she's able to bring in to these conferences. I mean, it's. You've got, you know, again, eyewitnesses to this thing. You've got, you know, Dr. Cyril Weck. You got Ed Tatro. I mean, the list of people is just absolutely amazing that are coming to this thing. You've got Bud Barnum and Hugh Clark, who are both on the JFK Honor Guard. You have David Denton. You have James Fetzer, like I said, Robert Groden, St. John Hunt, the son of E. Howard Hunt, Marianne Mormon, Andrew Craig, who's you know, one of the members of President of CAPA, Citizens Against Political Assassinations, the Trine Day Books founder and publisher,
Chris Milligan.
Yep. Phil Nelson, Roger Stone, Beverly Oliver, Larry Rivera, Dick Russell, who wrote The Man Who Knew Too Much about Richard Case Nagel. Like I said, it's just an impressive, impressive list of people. Robert Tannenbaum is going to be there as well. So like I said, just the list of the people, it's three long days. I mean, we do 12, 14-hour days. We're showing the film that I worked on with John Barber, The American Media and the Second Assassination of JFK. We're showing Randy Benson's excellent film, The Searchers, about the first generation researchers, like that. Just a ton of information, and it's very inexpensive. It's like $130 for all 3 days.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And is that the Crown Plaza? Is that right again?
Correct. Only three blocks from downtown Dallas.
Now, many of y'all are going to be held over for the actual memorial ceremony, in Dealey Plaza on
Correct.
The 22nd? And so this year, that falls on a Wednesday after the weekend of the conference, right?
Correct.
So y'all would be down there doing that. Well,
right.
Go ahead.
It's a great way for everybody to just, you know, to meet all these researchers, you know, get photo ops with them, you know, buy their books, DVDs. I mean, it's just an incredible opportunity.
Yes, it is. I did about 12 interviews last year up there. And I certainly want to sit down with you this year. I'll be up there also, but just for Saturday and Sunday, not for Friday event.
Well, this year I am. Last year I was pushed into rush duty to host everything on Saturday and Sunday.
Right.
So this year I won't be forced to do that, so I'll have a lot more available time.
Oh, good. Yeah, and John B. Wells, will he be the master of ceremonies?
Correct. And he was the master of ceremonies last year and obviously came in on Friday and then took ill Friday night, wasn't able to be there most of Saturday and Sunday. But he will be the master of ceremonies again for the entire week.
Right, right. Now the JFK movie, Oliver Stone, how accurate was that overall, according in your opinion?
More accurate than anything else that's probably been produced, for the media.
On that level, right, on a full movie.
Well, you got to look at it this way, okay? Yeah. That the stir from that movie caused the Assassinations Record Review Board, which caused all these files to be released. If Oliver Stone hadn't done that movie, we wouldn't have all this information that we have today. And again, he did that movie after seeing Nigel Turner's The Men Who Killed Kennedy, and he got interested in the case based upon that. Talked to Jim Garrison, found out, Garrison had written a book about it. Talked to Jim Mars, and both of those books were used as the basis for the movie. But people, because I had a small uncredited role in that movie, people say all the time, well, that didn't happen, this didn't happen. I mean, we had five or six things that we did for dramatic effects that, was technically not true. But again, it was minor things. He had a woman assistant DA in the movie. Well, he didn't on his own staff. L. Fletcher Prouty meets him in Washington, D.C. to tell him how the CIA is sabotaging his upcoming trial. Well, what actually happened was, Fletch went down to New Orleans after the trial to say, hey, this is how they sabotaged you. So like I said, certain things are in there for dramatic effects. But overall, that movie is still stands the test of time. And like I said, it is directly because of that movie that we have these files that just got released on Thursday. And again, all these major things that have happened is due to a researcher or a film person, because again, the American public trusted the Warren Commission that Oswald was the lone assassin. Well, not until Robert Groden released the Zapruder film in 75 did the American public get in a rage and write all the congressmen and say, hey, we're told the shot happened from behind. When you look at the film, shot from the front. And so that created basically the Church Committee, which basically the Rockefeller Commission, which basically became the House Select Committee on Assassinations. So again, everything that a researcher has done to, show the truth in this case has caused dramatic action to follow up.
Gosh, boy, I mean, it's building, isn't it? And I just hope, have you noticed what they're putting some conditions on this release? And one of them, I think, was put on there by President Trump that anyone that is still living's name may be redacted or not shown or whatever. What's that about?
Exactly.
But that could be the senior Bush, right?
Huh? Exactly. He's one of two men that couldn't remember where he was on November 22nd, 1963.
Right.
He later called his Houston office and said that he was going to be in Tyler, Texas that afternoon at like 4 o'clock or something. But and again, there's images on the internet that I'm not saying it's George H.W. Bush, but it looks an awful lot like him in front of the school repository. Okay. And if it's not him, that's fine. Okay.
Right.
But again, with these over 200 documents that weren't released, again, I think part of that is, again, certain people are still alive that, still need to be questioned on this thing. Okay, Hugh Ainsworth, for example, why isn't he being questioned?
Exactly.
Okay, why is Gerald Posner not being questioned? Here's an even better one. Bill Moyers. He's the guy that, supposedly ordered the bubble top off the limousine and then becomes a key aide to Lyndon Johnson. Why is he not being interviewed? I mean, there's plenty of people, besides George H.W. Bush, there's plenty of people. Dan Rather, the day after the assassination, went on air, panting, and said, I've just seen the film of the assassination, talking about the Zapruder film, Sears, and as Kennedy is hit, his head goes violently forward. Who told him to lie at 63?
Well, you know,
I don't care who you think shot JFK.
LBJ. Yeah, LBJ's wife, Lady Bird, owned Channel 7 here in Austin, which was a CBS affiliate. It was it was the only television station we had for a number of years here. See? Stuff like that. It's all tied together, you know what I mean? But one of the things was Eric Holder came down here a number of years ago when he was Attorney General. He got in up there in the LBJ Auditorium and lectured to us in a derogatory way about trying to do election verification or ID of voters. You know what I mean? There was a big demonstration outside the LBJ Auditorium, and Eric Holder is in there lecturing us about trying to do a stronger, more stringent voter ID. Can you believe that? Inside the LBJ Auditorium. And LBJ stole the primary from Coke Stevenson in 1948. Can you?
Oh, exactly.
I mean, this
in Dallas, Texas. The thing I love about the Dallas, Texas vote is, the recount of 201 people, and 200 of them voted for LBJ, one voted for Coke Stevenson, and he won by, I think, 86 votes. But what's more amazing to me is those 201 people that recounted the votes on, they all voted in alphabetical order that day and all used a blue pen.
Boy, that's coordination, isn't it? Captain Frank Hamer, who when I was 10,
let's line up in alphabetical order, and when I'm done, I'll hand the pen.
That's about as bad as that Sandy Hook, the little kid falling out of the deal, right? Anyway, so Captain Frank Hamer, when I was 8 or 10 years old, I learned Mockingbird Hill. He lived two blocks from us in Travis Heights, right, South Austin. And he asked me, he said, George, get up and sing that song, would you? We had a little barbecues on Sunday next to his house under this lanai, this little barbecue area. And I'd get there and sing. Well, I didn't know who he was really back when I was 8 or 10 years old, But he's the guy that went down and confiscated that ballot box in Duval County. Because he's the one that carried 12 bullets in him. He was fearless, and he was the only one that could do it and went down and got it, brought it back.
And you know who LBJ's campaign manager was during that run, don't you?
Who was that now? Was it?
John Conway.
Oh, yeah. Well, they revolved around that station, too. There was a radio station that Lady Bird had earlier, and some of those people were workers with, in that radio station. See what I mean?
Right. Well, and I'll give you something else that's a good nugget of information.
Yeah.
I talked earlier about Richard Case Nagel, and for people that don't know, he fired two shots into a bank in El Paso, Texas, and was taken into federal custody. And basically, he was supposed to either convince Oswald to be the assassin or kill Oswald. Well, he didn't want any part of it, okay?
Yeah.
Now, on November 22nd, 1963, there's a person standing behind Lyndon Johnson who is a federal judge by the name of Homer Thornberry.
Yes, okay? Yes.
For whatever reason, he was in Dallas that day, and he's standing behind LBJ on Air Force One. Well, when Richard Case Nagel went to trial in El Paso, Texas, the judge selected was Homer Thornberry, and Homer Thornberry told the attorney for Richard Case Nagel, "We will not be bringing up anything about the assassination in this trial." Well, that's the reason why he fired the shots into the ceiling of the bank. And now they're telling him you can't express your stories about Oswald, about the assassination, about why you did this thing. And, here's the judge that, is appointed to that trial. Just another coincidence.
Well, Carol. Yeah, just a coincidence, isn't it? Robert Caro wrote, I think he's on his fourth volume, I've forgotten if he finished, on LBJ's biography, his life, right? Well, he in there.
Yeah, a bad word about him.
Yeah, he wrote a correct rendition of the stealing of the 1944 deal, But, and then the Johnson family didn't like him after that for a while, you know what I mean?
Right.
But
well, like I said, yeah. I put in my book and I joke around about it, but it's not a joke. When do you take coincidence and circumstance and call it what it really is, a conspiracy? Because I have over 70, you know, coincidences or things that, circumstances that happen in order for Oswald to be found guilty. And again, if it's one or two, yeah, I can overlook that, but I can't overlook 70.
No. No, you're right about that. We've got about 4 minutes left. Gary, would you like to draw some conclusions or make some statements here towards the end of the program?
Well, you know, as you know, George, because you've interviewed me a few times and I speak at these conferences, I tell people all the time, okay, no matter who you think killed President Kennedy, let's say you think Oswald alone did it, Oswald with an accomplice did it, the mafia did it, Castro did it, the KGB did it, no matter who you think did it, okay, there were four things that happened that particular day, weekend, week that only our government could control. And the first was the Secret Service changing the route a day or two before the assassination to take the route directly by the school book depository where they had Oswald arranged as a patsy. Second, the Secret Service violated 16 different rules of presidential protection the Thursday night before the assassination and Friday during the assassination, including going out drinking the night before. JFK, the last night of his life, was actually guarded by the volunteer members of the Fort Worth Fire Department. Another violation that they did was if the car slows down to less than 44 miles an hour or makes a 90-degree or greater turn, you have to have Secret Service agents on the running boards of the car. They didn't do that, okay? More importantly, okay, it wasn't a federal crime to assassinate the president in 63, okay? The Secret Service illegally removed his body from Parkland Hospital and brought it back to D.C. for the autopsy. And when they did that, they took the hands of Earl Rose, a qualified forensic pathologist, out of the equation and put together three guys before that had never done an autopsy involving gunshot wounds. Okay, and then the fourth and final thing is, again, the memo from Moyers and Katzenbach that was given to FBI Director Hoover, who had no jurisdiction because it wasn't a federal crime, that said we must convince the public that Oswald was the assassin. And it states in there the only way to do it is to possibly have a presidential commission. And so, therefore, Johnson appoints the Warren Commission to suppress all the information. Those four things are only controlled by our government. Oswald couldn't get the parade route changed. Oswald and an accomplice couldn't remove the body from Parkland. Okay, the mafia couldn't have got the Warren Commission appointed. The mafia couldn't change the parade route. Okay, the KGB couldn't get the Secret Service agents to go out drinking the night before. This was all our government doing this.
Right, and the KGB didn't hold that party at Merkinson's mansion either.
Exactly. Exactly.
Huh?
And that's one of the best chapters of my book, in my opinion, is the Welcome to the Party, talking about the Merkinson party the night before.
Right, right.
And
his girlfriend, she added some statements he made, LBJ made to her.
Right, there's a t-shirt on my website. I need to get you one, George. I'll bring it to you in Dallas.
But do that.
On the right side, it has a picture of President Kennedy, and it says, when asked by Secretary Evelyn Lincoln who the vice president would be in 1964, JFK replied, it will not be Lyndon, and it says White House, November 19, 1963. And on the other side is a picture of LBJ, and under his picture it says, after tomorrow, those blank, blank Kennedys will never embarrass me again. That's not a threat. That's a promise. And it says, November 21st, 1963, Lyndon Johnson speaking to his mistress, Madeline Brown.
Right. Golly, boy, that's good, Gary. Well, man, I appreciate you being with you. What?
Great. That's what? Great. And, again, have everybody go to my website, theinnocenceofoswald.com. They can see a lot of the documents and a lot of the photographs that I use in my book, actually on the website for free.
Yeah, we got it up right now. Well, thank you very much for this evening for the interview. Boy, it was great. Thank you. Thank you a lot. Good night.
All right. I look forward to seeing you.
See ya. Okay. Bye-bye. Good night.